You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
All right, everybody, this is The Brian Callen Show. Hunter Motz cannot be here. He's off, I don't know, he's on a plane or something. God knows. I don't even know what he does, by the way. I wouldn't be surprised if he was into espionage. He speaks nine languages. And he blends in well with a crowd, and that's just because the way he looks. Very quickly, everybody, October 4th and 5th, I'm at Donnie B's in Springfield, Illinois. Then I'm at the Houston Improv, the 11th, 12th, and 13th. Always rowdy crowds in Texas. And then I am in Buffalo, New York. Never been there. Beautiful, beautiful Buffalo. Green, tropical Buffalo, October 17th, 18th, and 19th at Helium. So bring it. Without further ado, I have Sarah Rose on the line, who wrote a book that I found pretty fascinating. It's called For All the Tea in China, How England Stole the World's Favorite Drink and Changed History. And Sarah, there's so many things to talk about in this. Mainly, tea is still, I believe, at least according to some claims, the second most popular beverage in the world. I would think it was coffee.
Well, so China and India are tea drinking cultures.
That's
much trumps every coffee drinking.
You know what? You're absolutely right. You are absolutely right. And this is really a tale, about industrial espionage in a way. And one of the things before we get into the book, we should kind of establish and talk about is how important the East India Tea Company was. It was the first real corporation, world corporation. And we have a lot of talk now. Well, corporations control our government and blah, blah, blah. And it's all about special interests. Well, in fact, the East India Tea Company, in a lot of ways, did control a great deal of British policy, didn't it?
No doubt. And to an entirely real degree, they were the government. They were basically the Foreign Office. Great Britain.
So many people had stock, so many powerful people had stock in the company. And so their bottom line was very important to the power structure.
No doubt. The theory was that, just the taxes on tea alone basically kept England going as an economy.
Well, and then your book comes in, what I loved about it is you do a very good job of describing history really is not only the study of conflict and surprises, but also individuals, how one person can make a profound difference when they're determined or just curious or even by accident. And Robert Fortune is, I guess you argue, that man, a botanist, a spy, this phlegmatic sort of guy who was about a foot taller than everybody else, dressed like a Mandarin when foreigners weren't allowed. And I'm paraphrasing here, but the Chinese, I didn't realize that the Chinese were so guarded about their tea.
Sure. I mean, they were guarded about everything. Basically, yeah. From Marco Polo to Robert Fortune, nobody'd gotten in. You're talking about a good 300 years of they were completely self-sufficient as a country, and they, didn't need the rest of the world. They were as big as the rest of the world. They were at the center of the world.
Yeah, and they had the Yellow River and the Yangtze, I think, the two rivers that kind of crisscross that kind of could bring trade and goods, and the rivers were a huge part of that. I mean, it was a huge area of the world, but one of the most unique examples of an area that big where they all spoke the same language, Mandarin. And so,
well, now they do. They didn't 150 years ago.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Huh. You would probably not be able to understand each other. There were more regional dialects than, say, between, America and California by a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So now that was a sort of post-communist, post-revolution decision to make everyone speak the same language.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that. Okay, that's good. See, there you go. Why did you write this book? This is fascinating. What is your background and what got you to write this book?
Well, my background is I was broken, unemployed, and
yeah, that's what I like. That's the answer I like. Go on. And you decided to write a book on tea.
Right. And an ex-boyfriend said to me, I heard one guy stole tea from China. Hmm. You should look into that. And I did. He left memoirs, and the memoir. I got to the point in Fortune's memoirs, and they're terribly boring. They're really dry and Victorian. But I got to the point where I saw him fighting pirates, and I was like, "Huh,
wow,
pirates! Yeah. You know, I can do something with that."
Yeah, yeah. He went through. I mean, you described. He went through some pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah, and then when I saw that he dressed up in drag, I was like, "Oh, done." You know.
A pirate fighting drag queen who
exactly.
stole tea from China, basically.
And so that was the genesis, and the boyfriend, I dedicated the book to him. Here we are several years later.
Well, one of the things that, you know, I thought was interesting was that, you know, Americans drink coffee, and in fact, the British prefer dark tea. And, you know, I was amazed that the Chinese were staining the tea for export with Prussian blue, which is a dye that contains cyanide, to make the tea look greener, I guess.
Sure. Well, yeah, for green tea, because they were like, Europeans like it this way. We don't understand it, but we get higher prices. So why wouldn't we dye it?
Why wouldn't we dye it something?
Yeah.
But what's amazing is how contemporary your book is in a way, because there are a lot of stories about products coming out of China. Because it's such a vast area, and you're always going to have quality control issues with poisonous paints and tainted baby formula, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, and every time, well, and there's just the, you know, anytime you sell something by volume, there's some way you can, like, amp up the volume a little bit, throw in some shakes and seeds, you know, you've created something out of nothing.
Why were they so guarded of the teas? I think it was in the Wuhe Mountains. Why were they so guarded of... There were green teas, and then what I thought was interesting that I didn't know is the tea is all the same plant. It's just a question of how they process it. So green tea and dark tea, black tea, are the same plant. It's just a question of how they process the tea.
Right. It's the difference between boiled potatoes and roast potatoes.
Okay.
Your roast potatoes would be your dark teas, your black teas, and your green tea would be the boiled potatoes. They're not as processed. They're not as skin hasn't turned color.
But don't they grow the dark to black tea in higher altitudes?
Yeah, they don't grow in the same place. That's right. Mm. And it's less altitude than just sort of more like the Burgundian monks who are like, this hillside grows a really great Grand Cru, and this hillside over here, the only Premier Cru.
Wow.
It's just been that way for generations, and so that's the way it is. And when Fortune was the first person to realize that tea was exactly the same plant, up until then the taxonomy had been that they were two individual species.
Wow, yeah, okay. I always thought they were too, actually, until your book, you know.
And I mean, there's a lot of stuff we call tea that's not tea at all. Tea is a camellia; it's one plant. And when you drink mint tea or herbal tea, you're not drinking tea; you're drinking an infusion. And it's called tea because it's brewed, it's steeped, but steeping something doesn't make everything tea, because that would make chicken soup chicken tea.
Yeah. Well, I thought, you know, when I was 14 years old, I actually went to mainland China, and I went to a tea plantation. And I remember very, very well, they were taking the tea leaves. They were taking leaves, and they had these flat steel pans, and they would move them over a fire, and essentially that's how they were roasting the tea. And then they put this tea, this green tea, into a porcelain cup, and they poured hot water over it, and they gave it to me, and I was 14. And I remember just how unbelievably delicious it tasted. It tasted like buttery. It tasted like butter. It was something about it that was just – I'd never tasted anything quite like it. And then I spent the rest of my life – searching for that taste. And obviously some Chinese tea master had made me tea when I was 14. And it's kind of like tasting a Grand Cru Classe, you know, from Rothschild or something, and then trying to drink, you know, Malbec at some restaurant, you know. I mean, it really was a fundamental difference. I'm such a freak about my coffee, and by the way, my tea now. I make it a certain way, and one of the greatest, one of my favorite moments was my friend dated this Japanese woman, and her sister came to visit from Japan. Her father was this famous professor who taught the sort of the history of the samurai. And in fact, he was a direct lineage of very several famous samurai families and stuff. And I had read enough about tea making and also, you know, Japanese culture. And she was watching me one morning, and I made the tea as close to the way I believed a Japanese person would make the tea. And she later said to her friend, her sister, she said, you know, Brian was clearly Japanese in a previous life. I was so impressed with the time he took with his tea. I broke your walls down, honey, with my tea expertise. So anyway, I don't know why I told you that story, but I just like to go off on tangents sometimes because tea is, are you a big tea drinker?
You know, for several years, I couldn't touch the stuff.
Really?
Every day I would get up and I'd go to work and I'd have to write about tea. So the idea of coming home and like, going to the kitchen and making myself a cup just felt like.
That's so funny. That's so interesting. Why do you think Westerners prefer black tea? And why do you think Americans are coffee drinkers? I mean, tea really has never caught on in this country.
Right. So there are two different things going on. One, in England, by about the turn of the 19th century, England had completely outgrown its borders in terms of being able to provide itself with enough food for the population.
Right.
So they had to import calories, and the population is growing because everybody's getting kicked off the land and industrialization is making like life easier. You can have more babies and they're gonna be more likely to make it to adulthood. Cities are, you know, able to grow under an industrialized system. And so population's increasing. There's no way to like eke out more calories from the land because it's an island. So they have these sugar colonies in the Caribbean and later in the Pacific. And so England actually has too much sugar. They start growing sugar as a way of, you know, just pumping up the calories in their food. And I mean, they grow it for many reasons. But then they have a glut. And if you go to England, their desserts are like impossibly sweet. They're just painfully aching. Maybe your teeth hurt.
This is very true.
You know,
I've spent a lot of time there. Yeah.
It's because they had so much sugar going around. And so black tea can really handle sugar. It can also handle milk, gives you a little bit more protein. So it was a way of keeping people fed in the very basic level.
It fundamentally changed the culture in many ways. High tea became a delicacy among the elite, the aristocracy, and then of course it became the drink of the middle class. But you know, to have tea with the queen was still something, and to this day is something that is considered to be a great honor. You have this tea that obviously was never something that originated from the Saxons of the British Isles or anything. It was, in fact, it came from China.
Right. It came to England. The Spaniards were the first with an overseas empire, and it came via a Spanish bride, Catherine de Braganza, brought as part of her dowry. And so it came to England via one of their royal, marriages, and then worked its way all the way down through the society. Most things start at the top and then become sort of commonized. In America, the reason we're coffee drinkers doesn't have anything to do with our sugar consumption. It has to do mostly with the Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
In the earliest days of our republic, we've got a bunch of patriots dressing up like Mohawk Indians and throwing cases of tea over the side of the ship in Liberty Harbor in Boston.
Tea was subversive.
Exactly. And look, tea represented, it was a symbol of all the taxes that were being imposed on the Americans without their own representation. So it really was the symbol of like colonial oppression to America.
There you go. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. If you're a British sympathizer, then you drink your tea. If you're a real American,
exactly.
There really is something about, having your coffee black. That's what a man does, kind of like that. That's sort of the I always got that from my father, sort of, I'll just take my coffee black, go to work. What's this fancy cappuccino stuff? Anything fancy, tea. My father, I mean, this couldn't be more American. He's like, I hate tea. And I never understood why he was so, I bet you that's exactly what it is. It was just anything fancy in your drink, if you're a guy, is still to this day, I think, carries with it the residue of some form of subversion.
Right.
Well, what I love about tea is just the ritual. The sort of how particular people are about the cups that they drink out of. I mean, in China, in Britain, obviously you drank out of bone china. And that was considered, you know, if you had, and even to this day now, you know, among the middle class, but certainly if you were an aristocrat, you had a bone china tea set, right? I mean, that was something that. And I guess I'm not to be redundant, but china came from China.
Right. The china was coming, so tea is really lightweight, and both have to be properly balanced, especially against, I mean, when you think about these old tea clippers, right? We've seen the Cutty Sark, it's on the bottle of scotch.
Yep.
Those clippers have a lot of canvas. There's an awful lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the fastest ships ever under sail up until Larry Ellison, I think, probably beat them.
Right.
So they needed to be properly balanced below decks, and tea is really lightweight. You're not going to be able to, like, balance a ship against those kind of forces with just a keel and, you know, basically, like, empty hold. Tea doesn't weigh enough. So they would actually bring over china from China as ballast. It was just considered, like, you know, a bunch of rocks. We can sell them. We can make a little bit of money, you know.
Right.
But it's there to even out the fact that our cargo is silk and tea. It's incredibly lightweight.
Right. And then I think there was a British... it was a guy, and he created one of the oldest companies in Britain, where he started to create, you know, making china actually there in England. And I can't remember the name of the company.
Right. Neither can I. I know there's also a German company, but basically it took, you know, another 100, 200 years for England and Germany to figure out what the chemicals that made porcelain so light and strong were. And that, again, advanced industrialization by a whole lot. Suddenly you now could have porcelains coming out of Europe that were as strong as in the East. The tea trade, like, kickstarted yet another industrial moment for England.
Right, right. Well, that's fascinating. I mean, you're not really a historian, by the way. You're just somebody who fell in love with this whole story and this whole idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think of myself as I'm a journalist, I'm a writer, I'm a reporter. So
yeah.
I got a good story, and there were all these angles to it.
Yeah, and that's what was so interesting to me. I mean, you do a great job of it, especially with this whole, you know, to talk a little bit more about Robert Fortune and kind of, you know, because he failed. I mean, at one point, you know, the seeds that he brought back died on their way to India. And also, for a second, talk about how India, because India had tea before, I guess, Fortune. I mean, they were growing tea
but
in the Highlands.
It was terrible tea.
Right.
Yeah. So they had tea, but it was really gross. even today, like, there's not a lot of people who just love Assam tea. I mean, some people in England who really like a lot of milk and sugar take it. But it's a heavy, sort of dirty, thick tea. And whereas the Chinese teas are light, they're delicate, they have these bouquets, you know, they're gorgeous, they're like champagne. And so...
I can just see a bunch of Indian people freaking out right now. You don't know anything about Darjeeling or Ceylon, whatever it is. I mean,
now they've got wonderful teas, but at the
listen,
time,
backtracking.
They discover native tea. So the East India Company knows that China has this monopoly on tea. They want to break the monopoly because monopolies drive prices up and quality. You know, there's no check. There's no competition on quality. So East India Company has a lot of issues with only doing business with one supplier. And they think, well, wait, heck, we own this country right over the mountains with exactly the same growing climate. Why can't we own tea? And then the way they find it grows there natively, they're more encouraged that, in fact, there's no magic to growing tea. Mm-hmm. They could probably have tea of their own in India. So they send a research scientist, Robert Fortune, to steal seeds and get sort of better stock.
Mm-hmm.
If they know it'll grow there, if they know it grows there natively, they can actually, you know, seed it with, like, higher quality stock. This is done in the wine business all over the time, over the place. So Fortune goes, he gets tea from the finest growing regions, but tea spoils. It's like trying to import oranges.
Mm.
You know, you need to get them fast or you're just going to have a bunch of rotten fruit.
Mm.
Well,
back then you basically were at the mercy of horseback or foot. I mean, you didn't really have... Yeah.
And so even though you're only going from China to India, it's still over a month on the monsoon, on the trade wind. So in that month, the tea seeds were dying. And he experimented with new technology, what we now would call a terrarium, and figured out a way to keep things fresh, to kind of sprout them on the way so that they didn't spoil.
Sort of a mini greenhouse?
Yeah, it is a greenhouse. In fact, right. That's entirely what it is. That
which he, yeah, he was using glass, obviously, not plastic.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but his first, he was there for 3 years. His first year of collecting, every single plant died. Every seed rotted. His entire first year just was a total catastrophe.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, we should mention that foreigners were not allowed where he was. He was a foot taller than everybody else. He braided his hair into a ponytail, and I guess people considered him probably a nobleman or something. I mean, he couldn't really pass off being an actual Mandarin, you know.
Well, so here's
native.
The thing. Nobody knew. China was very, very big and also very close from the world.
Right.
And China, for a couple hundred years, had been ruled by Manchurians who were not native Han Chinese, right? They were northern people.
Right.
So what the Chinese know of the outside world? Not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They know that they're ruled by foreigners. They know that the people they're ruled by people from the north, and the people from the north are very tall.
Right.
And that's about it.
Right.
Like, if you're the average Chinese peasant, so you see this guy who doesn't look like you, you know, you think he looks different. You don't know he looks like a white guy. You just know he looks different.
Mm-hmm.
And the going story was, we're ruled by foreigners. And he comes in, and he says, I'm a foreigner. I'm from beyond the Great Wall. And you don't know he's not Manchurian.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I mean, when somebody's a foot taller and they're interested and they're hunkering over a plant, I would imagine usually you're like, I don't know, that guy is either into some weird stuff. Who knows? Leave him alone. It's not like he was going in there going, hey, Great Britain is number one. You know, he's dressed like a Mandarin and he's poking around in the soil, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were farmers too, so they might not have thought anything of it. And if they did, you know, you pay them off for not a lot of money.
Right. Well, what was his, talk about his sort of motivation behind this, patriotism, curiosity?
Right. Well, some of it, I think, was the class structure. So he's Scottish, and he's as educated as he could get coming out of the class he came from.
Yeah, I forgot to mention, that's a very important point, that he was not British, he was Scottish, and there was, at least in his mind, I think there's a big distinction.
Well, I think there is even today in Britain. I mean, the Scots were known. They had parish schools long before England had schools. So schooling belonged only to the upper classes in England, whereas in Scotland, everyone had it.
Yep.
And, you know, even in, like, Star Trek, you've got an engineer, he's going to be Scottish. They were just known as great scientists.
Well, there was also, you know, I think this was 1848, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the Scottish Enlightenment, this renaissance in mathematics and science was just around the corner. So
So David Hume is already, you know, on stage. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you've got Scotland already had this reputation because it had just more egalitarian schooling, and of being, that's where the smart people are. But within the class structure of Great Britain, if you wanted to rise up in sciences, you typically had a medical degree. And that was something that went to upper class people. And then you did apprenticeships. And while you were doing apprenticeships, you know, how were you going to eat? How were you going to live? Fortune had risen as high as he could. He was in charge of the Chelsea Physic Garden, which is, if you get a chance to go, it's so beautiful. It's this lovely little walled garden in the middle of London.
Yeah.
And
I'm just laughing at the idea of just, I think a lot of my listeners are men, young men. I can just see a lot of young men being like, I'll go to those gardens just as soon as I'm done with the bar. Anyway, the Chelsea Garden.
So they're not going to the garden. Anyway, it's spectacular. Your wife will love it.
I will go.
And that was as high as you could get. He was this scientist working in a garden, and there are about 5 jobs in England, and they're all taken by people like Darwin. And I mean, you know, like,
the competition's rather fierce.
Yeah, they came from real money.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So the East India Company, the Royal Horticultural Society, and the East India Company come to him and they're like, "Hey, we've got this gig for you. You'll have to be gone for 3 years, but you know, there's nowhere else. You're at the glass ceiling. There's nowhere for you to rise in England."
Well, it's an important thing to make pause for a second here to just let people know that. The great chain of being, you know, the class structure in England at the time was so strong, you know, that ceiling was very real. In fact, it was considered almost a sinful or almost anti-Christian to aspire out of the class in which you were born.
Right. They didn't want to give him guns when he traveled because they were like only gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
you know, are allowed to carry guns.
Right. That's right.
There was there are pirates in China. What am I supposed to do? So they're like, okay, fine. Here's your gun.
Practice evasive techniques. Yeah.
So the motive really was, like, profit. He couldn't make any more money where he was. He had four kids, or he would ultimately. And, you know, the empire was kind of this place where the class system wasn't as strong. It didn't have this chokehold. You could make a fortune for your family if you weren't born into the aristocracy. And so that's why he went.
Yeah. Well, there it is, the old profit motive. I love it. And changed in some ways. You could argue, at least this book does, that he changed to some extent the course of maybe even world history in that the tea now became so popular. And the East India Company, I think the East India Company actually went defunct, but doesn't matter because, you know, Britain was on the verge of their industrial revolution. And, you know, you make this point that the taxes on tea had at least in part fueled a lot of that industrial revolution.
Totally. And the East India Company did. Like, I mean, that's sort of the irony of this. They're the ones who funded this enterprise. They're the ones who have this great idea to, like, break the Chinese tea monopoly. And they did. They were totally successful in breaking the tea monopoly, and they still fell apart because bad manager.
Well, wasn't this at the same time we were selling or getting, forcing the Chinese to buy opium?
That's right.
Yeah.
There was a massive trade imbalance early on because China was so self-sufficient, there was nothing England could make in the early Industrial Revolution that China wanted to buy.
Yeah, we didn't want to buy it. That's right. We didn't want to buy it. We were importing everything. They were importing everything. Right. The British were importing everything, and the Chinese had they just didn't want anything the British were making.
Right.
They didn't want
England made wool and cotton, and China made silk. You know, England made, like, heavy stoneware. China made porcelain. Mm-hmm. They're like, screw you, England. We don't want any of your terrible barbarian goods. We have refined, like, worldly pleasures.
I think there were stories about, like, some of the British were able to sell, like, you know, some of their stoneware, and the Chinese would buy it sort of a novelty. They'd be like, I'll give you a shilling for this weird clock. Maybe I can put it up on my wall and say some Brit gave it to me, you know?
Right. I mean, in fact, one of the emperors had this, like, a adoration for British clocks. Like, he just loved the clocks, you know, and they had this collection of crazy cuckoo clocks, but mostly what they wanted was silver. Silver was useful. Mm-hmm. And so all the silver in England starts flowing into China, and they're like, we have a real balance of trade issue because we can't stop drinking tea, and we're going to run out of silver. And they realized that, you know, we could just sell them opium. We could create a nation of opium addicts.
Yeah.
We can seed a new market there.
Isn't that crazy? But they had already been smoking opium. I mean, I think China already had an opium problem.
Sure. Well, you know, if you increase the supply, you increase the addiction.
Yeah. But where were the Chinese getting opium? They were getting opium they were growing their own opium.
Yeah, they could grow a little. Mostly they get it, again, from the Himalayas. I mean, opium was being grown in sort of the northern, northwest of India, yeah.
Mm. Okay.
So the poppy grows everywhere. But
and they tried to stop British opium. They tried to stop the British ships from coming into their ports with opium, and that's what started the opium wars, essentially.
The very first opium war happens. The emperor's like, we're done. Stop getting my people strung out.
Yeah.
And there was only one port where opium was allowed, and the governor of that port basically dumped it all into the ocean, and it was millions upon millions of dollars worth of opium, and England was like, that's not okay, and they sent warboats, and English warboats were steam-powered, and China's navy, you know, was still using sad little junks, and they were humiliated.
Yep.
I mean, it was the first moment, and it is still, like, rankles China.
Think about that. Think about that. The British fought a war basically because the Chinese didn't want to do heroin anymore.
Yeah.
And the Brits were like, you know what? Guess what? If you don't do heroin, we're going to kill you. You can either get high or die. They should have called it that war. Get high or die. Bumper stickers. But that is actually a little known fact that was essentially the opium wars, and it does still rankle the Chinese, and it had, just think about how humiliating that was to them, how unjust that must have felt.
You know, a lot of our current diplomatic issues with China kind of boil down to this, is that 150 years ago they were forced to sign treaties that were totally unfair at the point of a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so now they're like, screw you. We have a little bit more power now. We don't have to be your,
yeah.
you know.
Geopolitics. Yeah. Well, that's exactly. why I felt your book was very relevant. That's why I wanted to kind of get you out here, because I just find it fascinating when you really study not only the motives behind why we do certain things and countries do certain things, but also the individual actors, you know, the people that really kind of went out there and actually did all the dirty work, you know.
It's the reason I love this kind of history, this sort of these books like mine, and I think of, you know, there are a handful of others like Longitude by David Sobel, like where, because you're talking about history, you're talking about this like massive world change, but people really like stories about other people.
Yeah.
People want to follow a hero. They want somebody to succeed. They want to see him fail. They want to, they want someone to hang on to and root for. And so when you can find that person, you can build the entire world around there.
You don't even have to find the person. A lot of times you can find the commodity. You can take salt. You can take cod. We had Mark Karlansky on who wrote a number of books on one commodity and the effect they had on the rest of our history. And tea is for sure one of the crops, along with cotton, I suppose, and things, but tea for sure is one of those crops, one of those commodities that had a profound effect on the world that we live in today. And it was really because people just loved drinking that particular beverage. It was very, that whatever, that caffeine kick.
It's the caffeine, and it's also, I mean, if you look at it in the moment of globalization, all these new diseases are coming in, mm-hmm. and tea, you boil your water, you've increased the like hygiene in your house, you know, by an order of magnitude. And the other way, you know, to kill bacteria would be to make your liquid alcoholic, right? Because mm-hmm. fermenting beverages kills bacteria, but mm-hmm. then you're drunk. Isn't always a problem, but it might be in, you know, a new industrializing country when you're standing at a mill with all kinds of like needles and looms, you might die.
Or writing, you know, The Origin of the Species, etc. You know, that's right. I mean, booze doesn't necessarily. I mean, Hemingway wrote a lot of stuff when he was, I suppose, he had some alcohol.
It didn't end well for him.
No, it didn't. It did not end well for him. But it's really true. I mean, it's fascinating how what a profound effect tea had, and you know, still. Tea is one of those things. I remember I knew a woman who used to say, sometimes when I'm overwhelmed, there's nothing I enjoy more than sipping tea and staring off into space. You know, tea has different than, I suppose, coffee. Tea
right.
carries with it, even though it has caffeine, it feels synonymous with tranquility and with, you know, I suppose you think of the Zen monks drinking tea and meditating over their cup of green tea, or someone who's sitting at their easel or in front of an empty page and sipping tea and daydreaming and looking into their garden and coming up with ideas. You know, I certainly do that. I don't know if I come up with any ideas, but there's something very soothing and bonding in some ways about tea. There's something that seems to be, tea feels like the kind of beverage you drink, with a good book on a rainy day. Coffee, not so much. Coffee always
right.
feels more aggressive. It feels like something that Napoleon would drink. You know,
and I think too, like coffee is something you do while doing something else, whereas tea is kind of its own activity.
Mm. Yeah,
you know,
that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. Why is that? Well, I wonder what that is about.
Part of it, I think, is just how you make it. Like the fact that you're typically, you know, you can make a pot of coffee, and so you can have it sort of drink it in mass quantities. Whereas you make cups of tea, and it's all this little ritualized thing of the tea bag or the tea leaves, and you know, waiting for it. Like you have to wait. With
yeah.
tea, and you don't really with coffee.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
pot will sit there for hours.
That's right. That's right. And was still half the tea in the world comes from China, I believe, right? I mean.
Yeah, about that. I mean, but probably also half the market for it. You know,
that makes sense.
A lot of buyers there.
Do the Chinese still drink green tea and not black tea?
By and large, yeah. They're mostly green tea drinkers.
Why do you think that is?
That's a good question. I think it's because you can just drink a lot more of it. Black tea has a higher caffeine kick.
And that's because the leaf is roasted for a longer time and the caffeine comes
yeah.
to the surface. Yeah.
And But also, I think it's so much of it is culturally constructed that if everyone around you is drinking green tea, you're a green tea drinker. And if there are people around you, or 1.3 billion of you, there's a lot of social pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. What is your next book?
Oh, I wish I knew. The book market has changed severely since For All the Tea in China was pitched. So I've just been writing magazine articles since. My last book proposal was not purchased by anyone. It became a magazine story and outside.
What was the proposal?
It was about, I was following two guys, two brothers during the recession who, instead of getting jobs, they're like, this market sucks. They pulled their money and they bought a sailboat on Craigslist and tried to sail around the world.
Hmm. Yeah, well, unless you throw some sharks in there. And
yeah, they didn't. Know. Well, no, yeah, they had. I mean, they didn't know how to sail. Not a safe thing to do.
Yeah, that I would read.
I thought lots of people would too, and it was popular for the magazine, but it didn't make it to the book length. So. I don't know. I need a new project. What should I write next?
I don't know. I think that the reason this was fun is it was this, you know, it was about corporate espionage, you know, was, and there was a lot of drama in it, and it was like kind of read like a novel, I think, you know, this guy goes into deep China and tries to get it to, you know, it's kind of like, it's kind of like, Iliad or Odyssey on caffeine, man.
God, that's the highest compliment I've ever gotten.
What an educated compliment, ladies and gentlemen. Well, Sarah Rose, we wish you luck on your next book, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this.
Thanks so much, Brian.
And we'll make your book available on the website, and I recommend it to everybody. It's great. So thank you.
Right on. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Keep in touch. Bye. All right, everybody. Well, that was interesting. Sarah Rose, she has a voice. Her voice sounds as though she drinks tea. She's got that very endearing, sweet kind of, I don't know. She seemed, I don't know how old she is, but sounded very young, but she's not really a tea drinker. But there it is, man. I guess some people decide we're going to steal your secrets. And that is, you know, that's still going on. I'll tell you a story. I spoke to a high-ranking CIA operative. And one of the biggest, our intelligence agencies and other intelligence agencies all over the world spend a great deal of time committing industrial espionage. They try to steal secrets, whether it's, that's why Apple and their factories are so secure, and for that matter, Google, and all these companies are very, 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 very conscious and careful about guarding their inventions and their patents, because other countries, including China, and we do it too, are actively engaged in doing whatever they can to steal those secrets. Now, here's the rub. Here's the problem. The CIA commits a lot of industrial espionage. So if Japan is coming up with some interesting electric technology for their cars, we want to, let's say the CIA finds out about it and we steal that technology. Here's the rub. Who do we give it to? Who does our intelligence agency give that information to? They could give it to Ford, but then what happens to Chrysler? They give it to Ford, and what happens to GM? Or they could give it to, whoever the American companies are. You've got to give it to all of them. Otherwise, one company has the advantage, and that doesn't necessarily bode well for our economy. So if the CIA is a publicly funded government entity, which it is, they've got to be egalitarian about who they give those secrets to. And that poses a very real problem for our intelligence agencies when they possess information like that. So they can just leak it and give it, or they can blackmail, I suppose, the company into, you know, somehow selling us this information. I don't know. But that's something that they talk about in those closed circles. Like I know, by the way. Like I know. But I did talk to a very, very, who's actually no longer alive, but a very, very a high-ranking CIA guy about that. and then I had to kill him because couldn't allow that information out. No, he did pass away. But that was something that I thought was fascinating. And espionage continues to this day. You know, we have always, you know, people talk about Monsanto, and I'm going to try to get one of these sort of Monsanto, one of these people on the podcast, these sort of genetic engineers. The fact of the matter is we've always genetically engineered our crops. we're doing it on a level we've never done it before. We're cross-pollinating genes, and you know, we're taking the genes of a jellyfish and putting it into a strawberry so it doesn't freeze, and all kinds of crazy stuff. And people are rightly, you know, apprehensive about that. They don't trust that technology. They'd rather stick with nature. I mean, I understand that. I feel that way a lot of times. But the fact of the matter is, science is a good thing. There is a responsible way to produce more yield and more nutritious yield. And in fact, there is some very good evidence to suggest that genetic engineering will cause us to have will allow us to not rely so much on chemical pesticides and herbicides and things like that. And a great deal of our pollution is caused by agricultural runoff. And if you can produce a crop that is pest resistant, that produces its own toxins that are not toxic, say, to a human being, but rather to the insect, et cetera, and doesn't need as much water and things like that, that's a good thing, and produces more vitamin A or vitamin D and things like that. Those are good things, but it's got to be done responsibly. And I think that there's a lot of criticism in you know, at least in LA, about Monsanto and sort of this genetic engineering, and let's stick with being organic. The truth is that we are not going to be able to feed our ever-growing population organically. It is too taxing on the earth. There's got to be a better way to generate more food using less hectares of land, and we are doing that. So that rising tide is inexorable. And in some ways, this book touches on that in a primitive way. But we are always, I believe, from what I've read, looking at how other countries are doing this. Other countries are actively engaged in trying to steal our secrets and getting into our labs. And food production is a huge part of that. So, you know, and then the question is risen, if Monsanto comes up with a seed that they can patent, should they be allowed to? What happens when bees go from one plot of land and they pollinate with those seeds another plot of land that has nothing to do with Monsanto, and now Monsanto owns those seeds? Can they sue that? I mean, it gets into all kinds of legal issues and problems. And Monsanto, in fact, has been accused of somehow pollinating organic crops with their non-organic seeds and material. And that causes a big problem. So ever the challenges of civilization, ever the challenges of expanding technology, it always raises different ethical questions and ethnic questions. But it really does. So we are in a new frontier. And that is, I don't know, I went from all the tea in China to now talking about agricultural innovation and espionage, but it's all part of the same conversation. So, my lesson to you, inform yourself. Political and philosophical commitment may seem like something you can avoid. I don't believe it is. I think it's very important to know where you stand and, more importantly, why you stand there. And that requires a lot of work. You have to investigate. You have to read. You have to read all different points of view. But I think at the end, freedom, individual freedom, is the most important thing. That is what the founding fathers talked about. And, that's what makes this country great. Not guns, but an idea, a living, breathing idea. And that is the Constitution. It is a verb. So don't forget that, man. A lot of other systems may sound like, you know, tantalizing socialism. But the problem is that somebody out there has got to enforce that equality. And whenever you see a government entity or any group of people trying to socially engineer equality, remember that at the heart of that, there is something coercive. There is something coercive in it. And somebody's got to be saying in a room, hey, I know what's better for all these people. I have a policy that's going to create equality. History would suggest that that's always dangerous territory. that is a dangerous road. And we're going to have the author of a book called Bloodlands on the podcast fairly soon, which is one of the more important books to read. And we'll get into that in some podcasts down the way. In the meantime, thank you, America, for listening. Once again, just so you know, I will be at the Houston Improv October. Hold. I'm so bad with this. Yeah, October 11th, 12th, and 13th. Then I'll be at Helium in Buffalo, October 17th, 18th, and 19th. Then I'll be in Calgary, October 24th, 25th, 26th. I seem to always sell out in Calgary. It's so exciting. All right, man. Peace.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.